Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, we'll find out about all the services that wetlands, or where the swamps and the popular parlance, what they provide for our American and global environment. Wetlands can help protect coastlines from the effects of hurricanes. They also filter out chemicals in water that run off from farm fields and parking lots and roads, so they act as a buffer between land and waterways. Right now, wetlands are helping improve water quality in the Mississippi River Basin, and they're important in climate change, we'll find out as well. We've seen a big loss of wetlands in the United States since the mid-1700s, about a 50% loss. In the Midwest, about 80%. We'll find out more about the benefits of healthy wetlands and the problem of wetland loss this half hour with two international experts. Bill Mitch is professor of environment and natural resources here at Ohio State University. He's director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park. It's right across the street here from the Fawcett Center, and we're going to find out more about that. There's going to be a big swamp fest coming up here tomorrow, and we'll learn about that as well. Bill Mitch, good to have you back.
Well, very nice to be here, Fred.
Joining us by phone, Royal Gardner is professor of law and director of the Institute for Biodiversity Law and Policy at Stetson University in Florida. Roy, good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be chatting with you.
And we're at 614-292-8513. If you've got a comment or a question, you can also email to openline at wosu.org. Well, you know, when I was a kid, wetlands were all, we called them just fields or swamps, were all around my house. And if I go back and visit that house now, they're all gone. They're all built up. So, Roy, a wetland loss continues to be a big problem in the United States, does it?
It does continue to be a big problem. In the past, we didn't appreciate the ecosystem services or the benefits that wetlands provided individuals and society as a whole. And we've seen historically a lot of loss through agriculture, but the loss continues now with suburban and residential development.
Now, is there a law in the United States that says, Bill Mitch, that if I'm a developer and I build some homes or buildings and a wetland is covered over, that I have to somehow mitigate that by creating a wetland somewhere else?
Well, it's more a policy than a law. It's been the policy of the United States for probably 20 years now that if you destroy a wetland, you have to mitigate that loss. You have to minimize it by doing something else. And that something else has often been to create or restore a wetland either adjacent to that site or somewhere else in the watershed. So, yes, in a sense, people call that wetland trading. You lose a wetland, then you have to go build one. And that's the controversy. Can you build wetlands of equal quality to the ones you're losing?
Uh-huh. So, in other words, I'm a developer. I cover up a wetland, then I put a building over it, and then I buy a piece of property elsewhere and attempt to create a wetland. Is that it?
Well, often it's they're working with public agencies. There are things called wetland banks now. In Ohio, we have a lot of them where they've already built the wetlands ahead of time, and they sell the credit to this developer who needs a wetland. I always thought that was a very clever thing. And so there's all sorts of different ways of doing it. But, yes, in a sense, you're responsible, and you're not going to – in theory, you're not allowed to have your development completed until you get a permit to destroy the first wetland.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get that permit, you're not going to have a development. So you have to get that permit. In order to get that, you have to come up with some plan, some mitigation plan, some way to mitigate that loss of all those public service functions that Roy talked about.
So I must do this as a developer. Have to do it.
Yes. Oh, it's required, yes. Mm-hmm.
So Roy does and Bill both, because since Bill, you have an artificial wetland right across the street here that you use for research purposes, the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park. Does it work to build a wetland artificially? Does it do all the things that you want a wetland to do?
Well, I'll speak first, but Roy, you should certainly chip in. I think you can build, restore, and create wetlands. That's what we've dedicated our life to training our graduate students to learn how to do. And I think if you know what you're doing, you can do it. Now, that's been the problem. There have been a lot of people who just don't have the I argue they haven't gone to Ohio State University, but they don't have the wherewithal to build these wetlands. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what to expect. They don't know what to expect, especially about Mother Nature. And even some of the regulators don't know what to expect. But can you create and restore wetlands? Sure. But you have to know what you're doing. But there have been a lot of failures.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, I agree with Bill. I mean, there certainly have been a lot of failures, although although it can be done. But it's a matter of having the technical expertise and also the financial backing to do it. Because one of the problems with some of these restoration sites is they are done, they're completed, and then everybody walks away, and there's no provision for long-term management or care. And you know, obviously at Ohio State, it's a different situation. But with a lot of artificially created wetlands, that is a continuing challenge.
So if I'm a developer and I make a development and then I create an artificial wetland elsewhere, if I just walk away from that and do nothing more, it may not turn out to be the kind of wetland with the kind of services to the environment that you would like.
That's correct. And historically, the regulatory agencies have not required that there be a long-term steward, that there be some entity that cares about the site and has the financial ability to take care of the site. There are some federal regulations that just came out the past couple of months that might change this system. I think it's a good rule, but we have to see how it's actually going to be implemented.
What do you want a wetland to do, Bill?
What do you want it to do?
Yeah.
Well, it's nature doing a lot of the work that otherwise we would have to do and do at a great expense. We want the wetlands to, of course, provide a beautiful aesthetic for the landscape. We want them to provide a wonderful habitat, biological habitat. They're nature's supermarkets is the way we explain it. That's one of the euphemisms we use. It's where critters come to eat or be eaten. It's where the terrestrial critters come down to the edge of the water, and the fish come in from the aquatic. So the biology is extraordinarily important, the biodiversity. We want the wetlands to clean up the water. They are nature's kidneys. That's another term we use for their function in the landscape. And one of the really important things is the wetlands are providing that we're more and more focusing on is protection from floods and storms and coastal hurricanes and all sorts of things, that they can take a beating and come back. And that issue was really amplified when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. All their wetlands had been, or half of their wetlands had been lost, destroyed, and they were just a sitting duck.
You say half of the wetlands were lost and destroyed. How did that happen?
Well, it's happened, by the way, that they've developed the delta down there, the Louisiana Delta. The Mississippi River no longer is allowed to flood. It's no longer to spread left and right, if you will, when the big floods come. And so all of the mud that we're sending down from Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and where else goes straight out into the abyss, into the deep water of the Gulf of Mexico. It's channelized all the way out to the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the delta is sinking. And when this delta sinks, the marsh grasses are the first thing to disappear, and all of a sudden there's New Orleans just sitting there as a big, gigantic target right on the Gulf.
So in other words, what a nice wetland would do for New Orleans, a big network of wetlands, when a storm surge comes and ocean water surges, it would absorb it? Is that the idea?
Yeah. I mean, you need massive.
Like a sponge.
Massive, yeah. You need 100 miles of marsh to do that. But yes, that's exactly what happens.
And tell me also about the filtration aspect of a wetland. I know when I walk over to the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park here, and by the way, listeners, you're welcome to come, and we'll tell you about the Swamp Fest tomorrow. And I see you have all kinds of testing devices, and you have students out there. And what is a wetland filtering out?
Well, in the Olentangy River, we describe it as having enough stuff to be interesting. It's not a terribly polluted river. It's not polluted with I would say, chemicals, metals, and so on. But it's got fertilizers from farm fields. It's got sediments that are running off from farm fields. So, and that's a wetland can deal with those. And so what it's filtering out are especially the particulates out of the water. It's filtering out the nitrogen and phosphorus that originated from the fertilizers that run off the farmlands. And that's its particular value. We see decreases routinely every year of 30-40% of nitrate nitrogen going through our wetlands. And we've used those data to be able to extrapolate, if you will, to what would be needed to take enough of these fertilizers, these chemicals, out of our rivers to help improve situations down in the Gulf of Mexico with another problem they have down there called the dead zone of the hypoxia. It's a long story, but it's a pollution that's because of the fertilizers up here.
Mm-hmm. So with regard, let's say, to the Olentangy River, the wetlands around the river can take some of these farm chemicals and other chemicals and other pollutants out, and therefore when the water releases back into the river, it is cleaner than it would have been?
Yeah.
Over time, do those pollutants degrade as the wetland holds them? Is that the idea?
Well, for certain ones like phosphorus and sediments, sure. I mean, it will accumulate. It doesn't degrade the wetland. That's a natural feature. But wetlands in a geologic sense are very ephemeral parts of our landscape. But things like nitrogen, nitrates especially, it converts it to a very harmless gas called N2, which we're breathing right now. It's 80% of our atmosphere. So it converts the nitrate, which was a pollution problem in the water, to a gas that's 80% of our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Bill Mitch is professor of environment and natural resources here at The Ohio State University and director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park here. Roy Gardner, professor of law and director of the Institute for Biodiversity Law and Policy at Stetson University in Florida. We're at 614-292-8513. Mike is joining us. Hello, Mike.
Yes, hi. How you doing? My question is, I'm just wondering, seems like that we're justifying destroying an existing wetland and creating what we think is going to be a successful new one, but all of the species that are at the wetland that we're destroying are going to be destroyed, and we have no way to magically move all of the salamanders and the frogs and the insects and those creatures to a new wetland, and that this new wetland that we're creating is actually in some ways a biological desert for quite a long time until new species have populated it, unless we have a magical way to also move species there.
Well, Roy, that's a good point. How you can't move the species with you when you destroy a wetland and create one elsewhere?
It is a difficult challenge, and one of the things I tell my students is that wetland law and policy it's really the intersection of law, science, and politics. And one of the things that needs to be balanced in this equation is, or at least considered, is the fact that 75% of wetlands in the United States, excluding Alaska, are privately owned. And so it's a difficult balancing act where you are regulating people's private property.
Mm-hmm.
And so occasionally, more than occasionally, they are permitted to fill in. What the regulatory program tries to do is get something in exchange for that. Frequently, it hasn't worked out. But as Bill was talking about with respect to mitigation banks, where some of the work is done ahead of time, there is a greater likelihood, not a guarantee, but a greater likelihood that performance standards will be met.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question, Mike. Thanks for your question. And on to Troy. Hello, Troy. You're with us.
Yes. Just a quick comment for your listeners who own property. I read Professor Mitch's book. We actually met once. I have some property that we're no longer farming that, we've traditionally moved and tried to make it so that it would shed water. We're now moving in the opposite direction, making it so that it holds water, and it's really worked out for us. We don't have to mow as much. We've got better wildlife. The hunting's gotten better. There are a lot of benefits for just landowners that aren't farming their land to read Dr. Mitch's book.
Mm-hmm.
It goes a long way.
Bill?
And that's my comment.
Bill, that's a nice compliment.
I'm honored that you're reading our book. Sure. If there used to be a wetland and it was drained for farmland and so on, and you want to return it to wetland, those are the easiest ones because you can get the hydrology back if it was there once. It's amazing sometimes how quickly those functions that we were just talking about with the last caller can come back. Some of the rare amphibians and so on will take decades perhaps, but some of the functions and a lot of the avian life comes back rather quickly. Wetlands can come back. Now, we only monitor them for 5 years formally, but in a 20-year period, I think you can have a very, very nice wetland that come back on your landscape.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Thanks, Troy. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You point out, Bill, that wetlands also function, I mean, in terms of all these environmental functions, the good things they do for us there, but they function in a sense of zoo. I mean, with your Olentangy Research Park, people can come over and see all kinds of incredible creatures, and that's a real benefit, too.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, our Olentangy River Wetlands is the modern version of a zoo. We don't put the animals in cages. They're out there, and you have to find them, so it's not as easy. You have to be patient. You can't expect them to be at a certain location every time you come back. But, yeah, that's the way it should be. And I think if you're patient, you can see a lot of wildlife, even in an urban area like we're in.
So what do you see, for example?
What
kinds of wildlife are there?
Well, we've got 160 species of birds out there, which is a pretty incredible list. I know the people from this Ramsar organization, when they came to review us, they were astonished by that. 26. Ramsar is this organization. Roy can perhaps give you more details. An international organization that keeps a list of wetlands of international importance, and we were named a Ramsar wetland in. This summer, and that's why we're having this exciting party tomorrow to celebrate this Ramsar. We're called a Ramsar Wetland of International Importance, and we're the 24th in the United States and the very, very first one in Ohio. And mm-hmm. that's pretty extraordinary for an area that has mostly created wetlands.
So about 160 species of birds over – and this is not that big a wetland, right? We're talking about how many acres?
If you count the river, which we do, we have 50 acres out there.
If you count the river. If you don't count the river, it's
about 39 or 40.
Yeah. Roy, what about wetlands in Florida? I mean, I've seen some incredible variety of bird species in some of the wetlands when I visited.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what we're known for down here in Florida, not only the Everglades, but throughout the state. We have wonderful swamps and marshes and mangroves. But to get back to Bill's point about the Ramsar Convention, this is an environmental treaty that focuses specifically on wetlands, and it's really the only treaty that focuses on a particular type of ecosystem. There are 158 countries that are parties to this treaty, including the United States. The United States joined this treaty under the Reagan administration, and one of the obligations of countries under this treaty is to identify and designate areas as wetlands of international importance, and the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park is now the 24th U.S. site. Mm-hmm. And the Everglades is one of the sites, Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge, Okefenokee. These are all Ramsar sites, and now Ohio State has a Ramsar site as well.
So, Roy, when you get such a designation for something like the Okefenokee or the Everglades, does it give it any kind of protection at all?
It's interesting. It's a non-regulatory treaty. So, by itself, it does not give any additional protection. Although the U.S. government will not designate the site. Unless there is a commitment to conserve it, and obviously there is in the case of Ohio State.
Sure.
But we actually did a survey of the U.S. Ramsar sites to find out what benefits are associated with designation, and we found that there were a variety of benefits in terms of helping with funding, increasing education about the site and wetlands in general, but also increasing scientific studies and ecotourism activity at the site.
Mm-hmm. Bill Mitch, I know that you've been to Iraq to talk about the possibility of restoring these vast wetland systems, these vast marshes that Saddam Hussein destroyed for political reasons. He didn't want his enemies going and literally hiding in the marshes, so he simply, I guess, ordered dams built. I don't know what he did to destroy them, but it's a vast system. And have they been able to reconstitute these marshes, which were living quarters, essentially, and life-giving living quarters for thousands, tens of thousands of people?
Yeah, that area you referred to is called the Mesopotamian Marshland, and it's in the southern part of Iraq. It's where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers come together before it flows down to the Persian Gulf. And we might add, where the Tigris and Euphrates come together, it was called the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
So the Garden of Eden was actually a swamp. Did you know that? What happened was Saddam Hussein tried to drain that entire location. They claimed it was for progress and so on and so forth. But what they did was almost killed off a culture that it called Marsh Arabs that lived there for thousands of years. They were able to live in this desert environment for a thousand years because they had water, they had flooding. And it basically destroyed almost the entire wetland area. after Saddam Hussein was captured, almost a day afterwards, the local people started punching holes in dikes and reflooding the area. And I think they're somewhere about 40 to 50% of it is now restored. They think they might get 75% back. They think they will never get it all back because of one three-letter word called oil.
Oil. Oh, you mean they want to set aside for drilling purposes.
There's oil underneath there, too.
But 75% isn't bad.
It isn't bad.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. We have our caller Chuck on the line. Hi, Chuck.
Yes. This is an interesting program. I had to leave for a few minutes, so maybe you've already discussed this. But one of the problems that I see is local political will and creation and enforcement of regulations, because since wetlands are not closed systems, the word stewardship is a good one, but it certainly doesn't address the real need of maintenance. So I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Roy Gardner, what would you have to say in response to Chuck there?
I think he makes a very good point, because you can't take a look at these wetlands in isolation on the landscape. They interact with their surroundings. And so if you just seek to protect the wetland itself within its delineated boundaries, that's not going to be good for it in the long term. You have to also take a look at what's going outside that area and what's going on all around the wetland.
Mm-hmm. Before we'll close in a few minutes here, and before we do, I definitely want to talk about Bill Mitch, again, director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park, otherwise known as the Buckeye Swamp, across the street here, and a big swamp fest tomorrow, right?
That's
Tell us
right.
about it.
Well, tomorrow, Thursday, 5 to 10 p.m., we're going to have an event we call Swamp Fest, and it was meant to celebrate the fact that we have been named the 24th Ramsar site in the United States of America. And it's just gotten bigger and bigger. It'll be a picnic. You can either bring food, or there'll be vendors that will sell food there. And Gordon Gee, our president of Ohio State University, will be there at 5:30 to actually accept the certificate, the Ramsar certificate, from Roy and who else will have, I think, was some people from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here. So he will receive it on behalf of the university. We're going to have Roy himself give a lecture at 7 o'clock on wetlands of the world. And we're going to have bluegrass and rock bands out there at the wetland, too. So it'll be quite a festive event. We expect 1,000 people to be there. It'll be fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Tell people now who've never been to the Buckeye Swamp, where do you go? How do you get there?
We are... Our street address is 352 West Doddridge Street, just north edge of the campus. Doddridge is basically Ackerman Street. A lot of people know If you get off Ackerman on 315, you're basically on our street. We are across the street north of Chemical Abstracts, where they have Picnic with the Pops. So anybody that's ever been with Picnic with the Pops, just go across the street and you'll find us.
Right next to the cemetery. There's a little driveway
The cemetery.
Yeah, good. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Hey, just a couple of minutes we got left. I wanted to talk about hypoxia, the depleting of oxygen in a body of water, and the big dead zone that is, I guess, very present, maybe even expanding in the Gulf of Mexico. What does that mean, and what do we know about it?
Well, I know that we just got a report this year. It's bigger than ever. And what we mean bigger than ever, it's a dead zone in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. It's caused by pollutants that are coming from up here in the Midwest, especially those fertilizers that we talked about a little earlier, especially nitrogen. It's causing algae to grow down in the Gulf of Mexico. It decays, falls to the bottom, depletes the oxygen, and there's no life in that entire area. It was the second largest hypoxia ever this year. That was before the hurricane season kicked in, and that is presumably due to the continued farming that's going on, but especially, we think, because of the increased use of fertilizers and so on to produce corn for ethanol. Mm-hmm. So we have this paradox going on. We're trying to be energy independent with a new energy source, and we're polluting the Gulf of Mexico even more.
So Roy, given this kind of pollution, are we thinking about the construction of wetlands along the Gulf? Is that the idea to mitigate this?
Well, I think in some ways there should be more wetlands that are constructed or restored along the Mississippi River upstream to try to filter out those pollutants before they get in.
Mm-hmm. But is there a program, Bill Mitch, and are you assisting with that program here at OSU to construct wetlands to prevent this kind of?
Well, we could be we have the bully pulpit on this one. We just are continually saying we've done studies and we've said that we need 5 million acres of wetlands in the Midwest, especially in the upper Mississippi River Basin, to make a difference. That is an enormous area of wetlands. It's getting working. We're trying to get it into our U.S. policy. We go to meetings. It's starting to catch on. One of these days, we're going to have a president of the United States is just going to declare it.
So we're going to need 5 million acres of wetlands, you say, in the upper Midwest. How many do we have now? How short are you of that?
Oh, we've barely begun.
Barely begun.
In fact, all these wetlands that we're creating for replacement are tiny, tiny amounts compared to what we would really need to make a difference.
There's a lot of work to be done.
A lot of work to be done.
Bill Mitch, Professor of Environment and Natural Resources here at OSU, Director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park, thanks for being here. Roy Gardner, Professor of Law, Director of the Institute for Biodiversity Law and Policy at Stetson University. Roy, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And when we come back, our election 2008 coverage of the presidential campaign, we'll hear the foreign policy positions of John McCain after these messages at WOSU 820. NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day.
Saudi Arabia is rehabilitating religious militants returning from Guantanamo.
You have to change beliefs by talking, not throwing him in jail for a long time.
The rehab changes some of them.
But promises of new cars, jobs, and money go a long way, too.
They become forgiving. They give you a chance to start a new life.
One country's controversial corrections program.
Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in just about 30 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Marketplace is the fresh sound of business and economic news. Get smart about money and business by understanding the people, local economies, and the world, and what it all means to us. Listen to Marketplace, weekdays at 6, now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
And taking a look at the weather forecast for today, sunny skies with a high around 80 degrees here in central Ohio for today. For your Wednesday, clear skies tonight and a low of 50. For Thursday, sunny skies and a high of 78. And on Friday, partly sunny. There is a slight chance of rain on Friday and a high of 73. Currently 70 degrees in downtown Columbus. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning.
WOSU receives support from Easton Shoes, serving the footwear needs of Central Ohio since 1954. Easton Shoes presents their Fall Trunk Show October 4th with Finn Comfort, Haflinger, and Think. Also offering sterling silver jewelry, handbags, socks, and more. Easton Shoes, 1880 West Henderson Road.
And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, we'll continue our election 2008 coverage of the presidential campaigns. This week, we'll hear the foreign policy positions of John McCain and Barack Obama. Now, tomorrow morning at 11:05, we'll hear from Obama campaign foreign policy advisor Richard Clark. This half hour, we welcome the senior foreign policy advisor to the John McCain campaign, Corey Shockey. My guest was professor of international security studies at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and formerly during President Bush's first term, she was the Director of Defense Strategy and Requirements on the National Security Council, again now Senior Foreign Policy Advisor to the John McCain campaign. Corey Shockey, we welcome you to Open Line. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513. If you have a question or a comment, you can email questions to openline at wosu.org. Corey, the Bush administration has been criticized by some for being too unilateralist, for not sufficiently seeking advice and cooperation of allies. And some people say we need to repair our relationship with our European allies. Does Senator McCain share that criticism, and would he do this any differently?
Absolutely, he does share the criticism. In fact, he was one of the earliest and the loudest critics of the way that the Bush administration was pursuing foreign policies that reduced America's standing in the world. John thinks that You know, if you're going to be a good leader, you have to be a good ally. And you, in addition to persuading your friends, you also have to permit yourself to be persuaded by them. I was just going to say it's striking to me how much John McCain approaches hard problems from the fundamental basis that the first thing you do is ask your close friends and allies what they think, how we can handle it together. I think you'll see a significant departure from Bush administration policies.
Corey, is there any particular is Senator McCain going to move toward our allies in a particular? I mean, will he meet with European leaders? I mean, what does he have any particular plans in this regard?
He would be presumptuous enough to start thinking about plans for meetings, with two exceptions. The first is that one of John's ideas for how we can rebuild the democratic solidarity of the West is to invest ourselves in a league of democracies and pulling together the countries in the international order that share our values and are willing to shoulder responsibility, but that existing international institutions don't create a place at the table for rulemaking. So, for example, Brazil and India, John believes that we really need to work in closer cooperation with them. And a couple of things we need to do early in order to make that possible, and they are places that John's been quite critical of Bush administration policies. First would be we have to close Guantanamo and find a better way to handle detainee treatment and adjudication, because that has done so much damage to America's standing in the world. And our friends and allies have been telling us that now for years. And John was the major force in crafting legislation like the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act in 2005 and 2006 to try and handle this in a way that protects America, but also does it consistent with our values, which he does not believe the Bush administration has done a good enough job at.
Does Senator McCain believe that the Bush administration countenanced torture and practiced it?
I'm not sure whether he has specifically leveled that accusation, but let me tell you what John has said about torture, that the United States should never be engaged in it, that waterboarding is torture, that he believes that we need to set the international standard for humane treatment. And he made sure that military interrogations would be governed and constrained by the Army Field Manual. And while he did not vote in favor of the Army Field Manual being what restrained intelligence community interrogations, the reason was that he believed that the intelligence community needed to not have a public conversation about their techniques.
Corey Shockey, my guest, senior foreign policy advisor to the John McCain campaign. We're finding out Senator McCain's positions on foreign policy issues. We're at 614-292-8513 for the next 20 minutes or so. Email to openline@wosu.org. Corey, what does Senator McCain want specifically to do at this point in terms of the Iraq war? Does he want to begin a drawdown of troops? To what degree does he want to do it? And when does he want to do it, if he does at all?
I'm so glad you asked that, Fred, because as I'm sure you know, Senator Biden's giving a speech in Cincinnati today that's making some outrageous accusations about John's position on Iraq. So I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to talk about what he actually thinks. John's all in favor for drawing down American commitments in Iraq, but our exit strategy is to draw down our commitments as the Iraqis become increasingly capable of taking care of the security and prosperity of Iraq on their own. And that the key difference between Senator McCain's position and Senator Obama's position on this isn't what they think. The difference is that Senator McCain believes that our choices need to be governed by circumstances on the ground. And Senator Obama is much more interested in a politically driven timetable that runs the risk of the fragile gains that have been achieved during the surge and the counterinsurgency strategy that we began practicing in Iraq at that time. that puts those at risk.
You say Senator Obama is interested in a politically driven timetable, but didn't, in fact, Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq agree with Senator Obama that there ought to be a timetable, and didn't he, in fact, say that the timetable was pretty much along the lines that Senator Obama had suggested?
He did say there should be a timetable, and he also said that it should be driven by conditions on the ground. Prime Minister Maliki believed in 2006 that it would be possible to draw down U.S. forces in 2006. He believed it in 2007. He believed it in 2008. So, you know, it is hopeful that we have an Iraq that wants to take responsibility and that it is agitating in order to do so. But Prime Minister Maliki's goals on the timetable tend to be aspirational, what he hopes they have the ability to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to watch what he's actually doing, which is not pressing for a drawdown of American military forces. That is, that he is pleased and proud, as he should be, that Iraqi security forces are stepping forward and taking a leading role in fighting militias in places like Basra, and increasingly taking a leading role where we are moving into a support role. And that's very much where House Senator McCain views the evolution as well. So it often gets played that Prime Minister Maliki endorsed Senator Obama's timetable, but it's not actually accurate. He supported a conditions-based timetable, and that's where John has been as well. Now, Prime Minister Maliki just hopes the conditions will be met very, very fast.
Now Russia has declared that South Ossetia and Abkhazia, these regions of Georgia, the independent nation of Georgia, they've declared them, as far as Russia is concerned, independent of Georgia, and they still occupy them. What does Senator McCain believe we ought to do in terms of Russia and this disagreement between us and Russia that indeed, in fact, we say it's an independent country. We say they should leave. Apparently, they're saying they're not going to leave.
Yeah. I'm so glad you asked that because I think this is one of the crucial national security problems that we've had to deal with. And I think the difference in the two candidates' reactions to it shows a lot about why the American people have so much confidence in John as a commander-in-chief. Senator McCain thinks it's really important not to confuse the victims with the victimizers in this, and that it is Russia that violated an internationally recognized border and invaded Georgia. And Senator McCain has believed for some time that the narrowing of civic society and democratic activity in Russia is a dangerous thing for Russia and a dangerous thing for us, and that while we can and should continue to have cooperation with Russia on issues of our mutual interests, like treaty-based reductions to our nuclear arsenals and containing Iran's nuclear ambitions, that those are areas of common interest where we can and should work together. But those common interests don't amount to a bedrock of common values of the kind that we share with other countries, and that we don't do Russia any favors and we don't advance our interests by pretending that the Russians aren't behaving in very dangerous and destabilizing ways. With respect to Georgia in particular, John believes that if we are going to have an enduring peace in the international order, it's got to be based on freedom, and that one of the most important ways the United States can help build that international order that we all want is to stand by the side of fledgling democracies, to help them build the institutions of democratic government and free and vibrant press and civil society. Georgia's engaged right now in that difficult and messy transition, and John thinks it's really important to stand by their side to help them rebuild their economy, which the Russians did an enormous amount of damage to during the invasion, to bring them closer and eventually admit them as NATO members. Our judgment is that the Russians would not have invaded Georgia if they were already NATO members. And that we need to rethink our relationship with the Russians and not give them the benefits that for example, of G8 membership, which is supposed to be designed for the world's free market democracies. Mm. And when Russian business practices are not free market and their country is not a democracy, John questions why Russia's risk represented there when India and Brazil, which are vibrant free market democracies, are not.
But let me ask you, Cora, if Senator McCain supports the admittance of Georgia and the Ukraine into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, Governor Sarah Palin, his running mate, was asked if indeed this wouldn't require the military defense of Georgia under NATO Article 5, you know, in the case of or the Ukraine, in the case of Russian troop movement into those countries. And she said, perhaps. I mean, where does Senator McCain stand on that? In other words, is he suggesting that under certain circumstances, war with Russia would be inevitable if indeed they invaded a NATO country like Georgia or the Ukraine?
I'm glad you raised that, Fred. What Charlie Gibson asked Governor Palin was whether, if a country were a NATO member, that meant other NATO members had an obligation to come to their defense. And she gave a factual answer, which is yes. You know, Article 5 of the NATO treaty says that an attack on one will be considered an attack on all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a grave obligation we all give to each other. But I also think it's illustrative that the only NATO country that has ever been attacked was the United States on September 11th. The first time that the NATO treaty obligation was ever invoked was when our European and Canadian allies wanted to come to our defense. I mean, it's a sacred obligation. It's a trust you give each other. And by giving each other that promise of a common defense, you dramatically reduce the likelihood of any of those countries being attacked. And so helping pull Georgia and Ukraine and fledgling democracies that live in dangerous neighborhoods and are being intimidated by countries like Russia, you help make them, you reduce the likelihood they would be attacked, and you also strengthen their ability to make the brave choices that will make their own society stable and democratic. I think the parallel actually is, there is an important parallel to Iraq and the difference between Senator Obama and Senator McCain's positions. If you give me another minute, I'm sorry, I realize I'm going on long, but I think it's a useful comparison, which is that the counterinsurgency strategy that John McCain had so strongly advocated and the Bush administration finally adopted for Iraq envisions that by creating security, you will make possible brave political choices that will strengthen the society. And I think today's passage of the provincial election law in Iraq demonstrates the logic of that. The Iraqi political establishment is making good choices because they now feel secure enough that we're going to stand with them and strengthen them. And that's the dynamic of a counterinsurgency, and that's John's fundamental belief about how we strengthen countries like Georgia, like Ukraine. You help provide security, and that makes possible the kind of brave political choices mm-hmm. that will build us an international order of strong, vibrant democracy.
But, Cora, do you think it's wise to admit countries like Georgia and the Ukraine into NATO when it could, you say, it will lessen the possibility that Russia might undertake military action against them? But in the event that Russia did, it sets up an immediate, under NATO Article 5, an immediate confrontation, mm-hmm. possibly military, between the U.S. and Russia. And wouldn't that be a very dangerous thing? Wouldn't it be wise not to admit Georgia and Ukraine into NATO?
Mm-hmm. That's a very important and a very serious-minded question. My answer to it, and I think John McCain's answer to it, is that we made the obligation of NATO membership to Germany, for example, in 1954, when there was a much larger and graver threat of war with Russia. But we did it because we thought a democratic Germany anchored in the West would advance peace and freedom in a way that was good for the United States and good for Europe. And so, yes, you are running a risk of confrontation with Russia, just as in 1954 you ran a risk of confrontation with the Soviet Union. But you also send a signal about how you want the international order to progress what your how your values and your interests will shape the international order. And John thinks it's really important that if you have a Russia that behaves in this way, you need to stand by the side of fledgling democracies and help strengthen them. And that will help shape Russia's behavior in more positive ways.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with the senior foreign policy advisor to the John McCain presidential campaign. Corey Shockey joins us tomorrow at 11:05. We'll hear from Obama campaign foreign policy advisor Richard Clark. We're at 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org. Corey, Senator McCain has been criticized by some who think of him as bellicose, and perhaps one thing they cite is the joke that many of us have seen on YouTube, in which the senator sang to an old Beach Boys tune, "Bomb, bomb, bomb, Iran." And there is some suggestion. And if you saw George Will's column the other day about Senator McCain in terms of temperament, as to whether or not there might be a bellicose nature to Senator McCain, which goes far beyond a joke.
Yeah. Senator McCain, as a veteran who paid a very high price for advancing his country's interests, appreciates, I think, more than most people what the costs of war are. And he repeatedly says whether the issue is Russia or Iraq or any other foreign issue of the day, that military force always has to be the last resort. We must always have exhausted our other means for dealing with the problem before we turn to force. And he's quite serious-minded about that. He's quite sober-minded about it because he understands the obligation that this brings for the country, and because he appreciates in a very personal way what the costs of war are. The McCains are a military family, as you know, not simply in Johnson's sense, but for generations. And I have never seen him try and trivialize just how grievous it is for the country to go to war.
Does Senator McCain find this potential Iranian possession of nuclear weapons, is that totally unacceptable to him if he were president of the United States? How would he prevent that acquisition of the technology for nuclear weapons? And I understand he does not rule out bombing suspected nuclear weapons facilities within Iran. Am I right on that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are right on that. But again, connecting it to your previous question, is that that would have to be the last resort. And Senator McCain believes that there is a lot we can and should be doing politically and economically that might affect Iranian choices about continuing to pursue their nuclear program. And let me give you a couple of examples. Senator McCain believes that, you know, he very strongly supports the sanctions that the U.S. Treasury Department and has done in the last several years against Bank Mellie, Bank Sadarat, and he would like to see those expanded to include the Iranian Central Bank, which is now serving to clear letters of credit and things for Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the very people who are providing training and weapons to insurgents in Iraq and other places around the world. He thinks we ought to have personal sanctions on the Iranian leadership that limit their and their families' abilities to travel, abilities to have bank accounts outside Iran. He thinks we ought to be sanctioning the import of petroleum to Iran. Oddly enough, they're one of the world's largest oil producers, but they cannot refine their own gasoline. And so there are lots of means of leverage we have that will not only show the Iranian government how the international community views them being in violation of four UN Security Council resolutions, mm-hmm. demanding an end to their suspension, but that we also have the possibility of fostering a debate internal to the Iranian leadership about whether they want to continue on the path that they're on, because it will grow costly to them in ways that they clearly want to avoid. So continue UN sanctions, because it matters to have the the Chinese and the Russians also helping us on this. We and the Europeans are taking even more sanctions than that. We need to isolate the Iranian leadership, show them international condemnation rather than hold high-level meetings with the Iranian president who, his comments about wiping Israel off the map are well known. So, yeah, John thinks it would be unacceptably dangerous to the United States to have this Iranian regime armed with nuclear weapons. But he thinks there's a lot we can do politically and economically before we come to the point that we have to think about military strikes on the Iranian nuclear facilities.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of Afghanistan, there appears to be a deterioration of security conditions there. Taliban forces are attacking, particularly, I guess, in the southern provinces. Does Senator McCain believe we should increase the U.S. Troop commitment there? Some foreign policy analysts, notably Juan Cole of the University of Michigan, are suggesting that indeed part of the reason for the increase in attacks is the presence of NATO forces, and that another possibility might be reducing the number of forces. And if terrorists did establish a training camp in Afghanistan, we would be able to see that with spy satellites and essentially bomb it. Do we really want to get involved further with more U.S. troops in Afghanistan and potentially suffer the same fate as the Soviet Union?
Well, Senator McCain's belief is that that we do need more troops in Afghanistan. General McKiernan, the U.S. and NATO commander there, has asked for 3 more brigades of troops. And Senator McCain's a big believer that you need to listen to the people on the political and military leadership on the ground and give them the resources they say they need to succeed. And so in mid-July, Senator McCain outlined what is his strategy for winning in Afghanistan. And I think more troops is a piece of it, but it's one of 7 things that we need to do to get our act together and get greater unity of purpose with us and our allies in Afghanistan. We need to give the commanders the troops they need, but we also need to be able to bring the kind of counterinsurgency approach that is succeeding in Iraq, bring those same kinds of principles. You create security, and that gives political space for the kind of change that you want. We haven't done enough of that in Afghanistan. Senator McCain believes that we need to double the size of the Afghan National Army so that they can be a greater contributor to securing their own country. We need to set political benchmarks that will help us and the Karzai government broaden and deepen democracy in Afghanistan. He wants to appoint a special presidential envoy to get the countries of the region more involved in a supportive political dynamic, which the Bush administration has not done. He believes we need to get our house in order inside the U.S. government, both in terms of unity of the military command and greater unified political effort. So there are 6 or 7 things that Senator McCain thinks. No single one of them is by itself the be-all and end-all, mm-hmm. but they will add up to a successful strategy for Afghanistan.
We just have less than a minute left, but recently United States troops have pursued from Afghanistan, attacking troops into Pakistan, pursued them into Pakistan over protests of the Pakistani government without Pakistani government permission. Does Senator McCain support that?
Senator McCain believes that we can't succeed in Afghanistan, and in fact, we can't succeed in the struggle against violent Muslim extremism unless we have the help and the assistance of the Pakistani government. And so he doesn't think a public conversation about what we would or wouldn't do without Pakistani government approval actually helps the Pakistanis work in conjunction with us.
All right. And on that note, we must close. Corey Shockey is a senior foreign policy advisor to the John McCain presidential campaign, and we thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Fred. It's been a pleasure to talk to someone as well-informed and thoughtful as you are.
Well, thank you. And this is listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.